My talk today is about Students Producer. I'll be speaking for 30 minutes plus, so there may be time for some questions, but if not, as Andy said, we'll have plenty of time this afternoon. I am the Dean of Teaching and Learning, and I have been at the University of Lincoln since 2007. I'm also the Director of the Graduate School, and since I've been at Lincoln, I have been involved with the Centre for Education Research and Development and worked very closely with colleagues in that unit, which is now headed up by Dr. Andrea Abbas. Before Lincoln, I taught political sociology at Warwick for 15 years. So I am a political sociologist, so I think about things in the way in which political sociologists think, or some of them think. And before that, I worked in community education in South London for 15 years. I got my first job in South London in 1979, working with young unemployed men and women, and carried on with that for 15 years in community education, working with the kind of young people who, because of the opportunities, were miles away from higher ed, not because of what they were capable of doing, but because of the situation that they found themselves in. And my writing is now about academic labour and student life. That's my research. And particularly higher education and its alternatives, if there are any, and I think there probably are. And to support my talk, I have this morning tweeted some papers that will give you more substance to what I'm going to be saying. So you can find everything I'm saying on those papers if you're more interested, on the hashtag SASPConf. Okay. So what is Student as Producer? Student as Producer is the organising principle for all teaching and learning at the University of Lincoln, across all levels of the curricula and across all subject areas. It is the teaching and learning strategy. That means research and research-engaged teaching is our default position. That's not to say all our teaching is research and research-engaged. That would be pretty excruciating. But that's the default. That's where we begin. And as we heard yesterday from Dan Derricotte, it's also the organising principle for our student engagement policy. And we say the students are producing the university. Now, this project has been ongoing since 2007. So we've been working on this for quite a long time. And in 2010, it was adopted by the university as the organising principle for teaching and learning. And in 2010 also, we were fortunate enough to get money from the HEA, which we've had for 3 years, which I was talking about yesterday. And this conference marks the end of that funding period. But Students Producer is scheduled to run till 2016, by which time we'll all be very, very sick of the idea and want to talk about something else, I'm sure. And I've been working on the project very closely with Andy Haggyard, who, let me say, has done a terrific job on developing and supporting the work with both his intellectual integrity and quality. He's a wonderful person to be worked with. What I'm going to present you with this morning is a very schematic overview of what is a very messy reality. I understand the importance of critique in all of this, and hopefully the talk will reflect that. But in explaining to you what Students Producer is, forgive me if I appear somewhat evangelical. I don't mean to, but it's sometimes hard not to. But I'm well aware of, and you will be well aware of what it's like to have this kind of an idea, this ambitious idea and trying to put it into practice across a whole university, and the challenges and the opportunities that presents. But before I go into more detail about student as producer, let me just please give you some context, which I'm sure you'll be well aware of. Student as producer has emerged out of a crisis in higher education, its meaning and purpose, and the way in which we're forced into an increasingly narrow agenda with a student as consumer, the marketization of higher education, and the pedagogy of debt. And the crisis of higher education is part of a much wider crisis, a crisis of market-led social development, a crisis at the level of society, an economic, social, and political crisis, which appears to be on the point of collapse. If a return to growth is possible, if it can only be achieved, and the policy is in place, through the intensification of work, increasing unemployment, precarity, casual labour, and the consequences for the environment that are beyond human imagination. And that's if it's working. So that's the first contextual point. The second contextual point is higher education is dysfunctional. The two core activities of higher education, research and teaching, work against each other. That's not just what I think. The Boyer Commission in the US in the 1990s, which was called the Reinvention Committee, highlighted this problem in American universities and attempted to do something about it. And in the UK, some people have realized the seriousness of this problem. And have been attempting to do something about it. And let me say, Professor Mick Healy has been at the forefront of that movement, of attempting to deal with the problem of research and teaching being dysfunctional, and rather than simply avoid the problem, or treat it, as we heard from Phil yesterday, as two not connected activities in the way in which the Minister of Education is thinking about it, but trying to find a way of re-engineering the relationship between teaching and research in a way that will create an institution that we'd all like to work in. A different kind of institution. A university, in other words. So that's the context. We're working in a situation of crisis, both an institutional crisis, a social crisis, and we're working in an institutional context that is dysfunctional. All right. Student as producer, as I said yesterday, works on three levels, or I like to think about it in terms of working on three levels. It works at the level of the classroom, by which I mean the learning environment and the learning landscapes. It works at the level of the institution, but it's also part of a much wider social movement that exists outside of this university, around the world, to protect and defend and reinvent the idea of the public university. That is to say, the idea of the university as a radical political project. Not simply an economic issue, not even simply a sociological project, but a political project. And together with colleagues in CURD, a couple of years ago, we published a book called Teaching in Public. There's a series of chapters where we discuss this issue in relation to our own teaching practice. So they're the three: classroom, institution, level of society. And what I'll do in the remainder of my talk is I'll go into these three levels one by one, and then I'll say where we are now in terms of the evaluation of the project, and where we might want to go in the future, and work we're doing to progress student as producer, so that it's not co-opted, so that it doesn't simply become another managerial exercise. We're very, very aware that we have to keep radicalizing what we do, refreshing, radicalizing, and to write our own critique as we go along, and not only to write it, but to do it, which is which is not exactly the same thing. But before I begin, I still haven't begun. It'll take a long time to begin. Before I begin, you think I've begun, haven't you? I've been going for, what, 10 minutes? Yeah. Okay, student's producer, the name. Okay, it's not student's partner. It's not student's co-producer. I have never used that concept in my life, student's co-producer. And it's not student as change agent either. Student's producer comes from the title of a lecture that was written, although we're not sure if he actually presented it, by Walter Benjamin to the Society of Anti-Fascists in Paris in the 1930s. And the title of the lecture was Author as Producer in 1934. And the problem for the lecture that he was worrying about, remember this is Paris in the 1930s, and he's a Jewish Marxist intellectual. And the question is, how do radical intellectuals act in a moment of crisis? How do radical intellectuals act in a moment of crisis? And his a part of his solution was that we need to transform the social relations of production so that students become, and others, become collaborators in the process of production, real collaborators in the process of production, not victims of the process. Right now, people argue we are victims of a process. We're the objects of a process. We're employed or we're unemployed, for example, often with very little to do with ourselves. So that we become the subjects rather than the objects of history. The subjects rather than the objects of history. And you see, we've got that slogan on our whatever it's called. What's that called? What is that called?
A thing.
What matters is the exemplary character of production. Can you see that? Which is able first to induce other producers to produce, and second to put an improved apparatus at their disposal. An improved apparatus. So we want to improve the apparatus and put it at their disposal. And this apparatus is better for more consumers. It's able to turn into producers, that is readers or spectators, into collaborators. Okay, so can we, in the University of Lincoln, improve the apparatus at the disposal of students and ourselves in order to turn students into collaborators? Not just into the production of knowledge, but into the production of history and into the production of themselves. Listen. Not all academics at Lincoln are revolutionary Marxists. I used to say that I was the only one, but maybe I'm not. Or maybe others, I think they probably are. But the point is that through finding a way of talking about the issue in that way, I think we are grounding teaching and learning in a way that provides a critical framework for a debate. Not asking people to agree with us. This is a university. We don't want agreement. We want, as Bill Redding talks about, dissensus. Dissensus, not agreement. A debate about learning and teaching and higher education in a very different intellectual framework from the one that's provided for us by the Ministry of Education or even the Higher Education Academy. Yeah. And I support the Higher Education Academy, absolutely. So trying to provide a framework, a critical framework, in the university and outside the university. The extent to which this actually takes place is very problematic, and the opportunities we get actually to have these kind of debates, but we do get them. From time to time, we do get them. And we are able to say exactly what we think and exactly where student producer comes from. And in this way, in a context in which we're overwhelmed by the language of managerialism, overwhelmed by the language of it, which by any academic measure is not something that anybody would want to or would be able to defend very easily. But the fact, and I think the concepts of managerialism are enshrined in the notions of partnership and co-production. So this is an important matter. So the fact that our title for the teaching and learning strategy at Lincoln is based on a 20th century avant-garde Marxist intellectual, I think is something of a triumph, if a small one, and I'm going to hang on to it. Okay, the three levels. First level, classroom, learning environment. Students produce promotes research-engaged teaching across the whole curricula in collaboration with students and academics. As we know from this conference, there's nothing unusual about that. It's going on everywhere. Your paper at this event are evidence of this. As Kevin Jeggs keeps telling me, that there's nothing, Kevin Jeggs is over there, there's nothing new in student producer. We've been doing this anyway. And indeed we were. And Lincoln was before I got here. We had a scheme to fund students doing research before I got here. But what we did was we used what was already happening. We did a review and an audit and some research to find out what was going on and built on that. And what was a slightly marginal activity, we made it into the mainstream activity. And in a way to support and generate a sense of ownership at the grassroots level among academics and for papers that were written for committees so that it could be approved by the senior managers committee, senior managers. And when we began, we didn't begin with student as producer. That idea had been generated at the University of Warwick and still is used at the University of Warwick. And Caroline over there from the University of Warwick runs a fund which is still called student as producer. But we hadn't fully developed it. And when we began at Lincoln, the idea was, which again was something I got from a colleague at Warwick, was to set up an undergraduate degree by research. That was the original idea. So, and these wouldn't be all our degrees, they would just be some of the degrees. And we went out and talked to academics, and very quickly we found out that that just wasn't going to work for a whole number of reasons. But through doing that process, we learned and we involved more people. And we talked a lot about research-engaged teaching, and we used Nick Healy's work and Alan Jenkins's work to support and defend. And it was only in 2010 we started to talk about student as producer in this way, when we felt more confident about what we were doing, and we were able to use this kind of language. And what we do now at Lincoln is every year we ask departments to complete a self-assessment form setting out how they've developed student as producer. And from time to time, we have festivals to celebrate this work across the whole university. But the main point is, I think, is that student producer is not changing anything fundamentally in terms of the activities in the curriculum. But it's using them to develop a framework and to reconnect the core activities in a way which involves students in the decision-making processes. So that's the first thing. The second level is the institutional level. Now, this is the level, I think, that makes Lincoln very special. I think the crucial point about student producer is that it turns these activities into the organizing principle for the university, the whole university. I don't know any of the university that does that in the UK. Not really, I don't think so. Maybe that's a reason why we shouldn't be doing it rather than should be doing it. Anyway, we're doing it. And where we have done that is developed a series of platforms, or as Walter Benjamin would call techniques. In the German sense of the word, it's not simply a technique like a learning how to do something, but a social organization, a form of, it's a social arrangement, a series of social arrangements at the level of the institution. And I'm just going to talk about some of those now. And those arrangements are bureaucracy, teaching education and teacher support, student engagement, I'll say a little bit about, estates, the design of the classroom, and technology, which is something we're really only just beginning to work on, but really with student as producer in the middle of it. All right, bureaucracy. The first thing is we've made bureaucracy, I'd like to think, into a radical instrument to support the work. So bureaucracy is not something that I'm against. In fact, bureaucracy, I think, helps us to establish an ethical and moral framework for the work in which we are doing. And there's work by sociologists who've written and are increasingly writing about bureaucracy as a framework, as a critical framework against the amoral, enterprised, business-focused, networked, connected university that we're all supposed to work in, which has no moral or ethical principle whatsoever. It's not designed to have such. It might have rules and regulations and protocols, but it has no moral and ethical framework. So bureaucracy, according to Paul Degay's version of Max Weber, which is quite a radical reading, I think, but in a series of books, he's written about bureaucracy as a way of generating an ethical and moral framework based on values decided within an institution and in an academic context, sharing, collaborating, critique, peer review, and so on. And we've turned this into a concrete activity through our QA protocols and procedures. So I think the most important achievement in some ways of Students Producer was when the quality officers decided they were going to go with it, after spending some time being rather against it. As you might imagine, they have a difficult job to do, and risk is not something that they want to be too involved in when they've got a whole institution in the QAA breathing down their neck. We were in the fortunate position that the QAA had come to see us in 2008 and encouraged us to do this. They encouraged us to take risks. They say, and I believe them, that they are interested in enhancing organisational change. So the way in which we did that was through the QAA. So now all programmes that come up for validation and revalidation are asked, we challenge and invite, because it's not compulsory, it can't be compulsory, we can't make this compulsory, we challenge and invite academics to get involved in looking at certain aspects of their new programmes. To what extent is research and research like teaching involved from the beginning of the programme? To what involved are students involved in the design and the development of their programmes? So that provides us with an institutional way for embedding the process in the curriculum. And there isn't a template for doing this. We ask each subject area to do it in the custom and tradition of their own subject area. Can you reinvent, re-engineer the relationship between research and teaching in your subject area because it's dysfunctional? We know it's dysfunctional. Can you fix it? How would you fix it? And what can you learn from the way in which, what can we all learn from the way in which you fix it? Because we don't have, you know, we don't have the solution to the problem, but we're just asking the question in a different way. We run it through the periodic annual reviews, we run it through the annual monitor reports, we ask external examiners to comment on it. I meet all the new external examiners and we go through it and we talk about it, and some of them love it and some of them hate it. So it's an organic, slow, developmental process, a very messy process. I read all of this materials, or most of it, particularly the revalidation papers, and I sit in those meetings. So I know how messy and difficult it is. So I'm under no illusions about that. And you might know the QAA came in 6 months ago and did a review on the university, and they gave us a commendation for our learning support. And Students Producer was mentioned in their report 9 times. I counted them, 9 times. And as the organizing principle for the whole process. So, and that's helped us and given us more support, and we'll kick on with that. Student engagement, okay, that's one level of technique. The next level is student engagement. I'm not going to say very much about that because Dan talked about it so eloquently and importantly yesterday, and the work that he is doing is so incredibly important, and it's wonderful to see it taken off. But let me say that student engagement in the way in which we talk about it is simply not possible in the neoliberal university, in the structures that we're all working in, academics and students, in the increasingly narrow management process, senior managers making more and more decisions. So we simply, it's simply not possible to involve the way in which we would like to do it in this model that we're working in. So we need to invent another model. And I think, and other colleagues think, that a model we can use, a different management model, is a cooperative model. A model where the whole institution is run by academics and students running the whole thing, and who would elect every year or every few years the VC, if that's what we call them. And you should know that in Lincoln, Chris, could you flick the thing? I just want to show you, and we won't have any time to talk about this, but I just want to show you what a group of academics and students and activists and people who wouldn't call themselves activists have set up in Lincoln. We have set up a higher education cooperative, a free higher education cooperative that exists entirely outside the university structures, that has nothing to do with the university structures other than it's an academic intellectual higher education project. And students, we say, will leave the reinvention center, sorry, the student social science center. Students, scholars, we don't refer to students and teachers, we're trying to reinvent a new language. They will leave the social science center, if they ever leave, with an award at the level of HE. And that won't be validated by HEFCE or QAA, it'll be validated by us, the academics and the students, working together with external academics. Same way in the university, we have external associate members of the cooperatives, world-leading academics, who are prepared to assess and peer review the work. And people are, you might not be surprised, are very interesting in what are very interested in what we were doing. And 2 weeks ago, there was an article in the Times Higher on the work that we are doing, a feature article with the title, which was a quote from Sarah Amsler, who works in CURD, a rather wonderful quote, "Something New in Freedom." This was, I think 2 weeks ago it was in the paper. So you can read about this. So the situation is in crisis, the situation is difficult, the situation is impossible, but that's not to say that we can't do things about it. And you should also know that there are meetings going on at a national level, organized through the Cooperative College and the Cooperative Movement in Manchester, to create a cooperative, national cooperative university. What exact form that would take, who knows? And there's a meeting next week on the 4th of July, called Cooperative Education for the Crisis, and I've been invited to speak at that. Okay, could we go back to students, Bruce, please? Okay, teacher education is a strand we are working on, another support technique. So all teachers at Lincoln, we say, are required to have a teaching qualification or an HEA fellowship. We as a university thought about this, we negotiated with each other, we discussed it, we wrote papers about it, and we decided. We decided this 3 years ago, before the Brown Review and before the KISS information, which now says how many teachers are qualified. We decided to do this because we thought teaching is a very important activity in the university and we wanted to give it full credit. But we also saw it as an opportunity for talking to our teachers about student as producer. So it would give us an opportunity to discuss that in an intellectual way. And alongside that, we've tried various experimental frameworks, such as the Teacher Network, which is an informal network of teacher support. And all of this, as we know, is a slow and grinding process where resources and workload is a constant issue and the imperatives of the ref, but we are working on it. And things come out of it. Things are already coming out of this. Things we didn't imagine when we began. Critical things, new things, not students producer things, but academics are learning about. There is a framework in the university that they didn't know about, and that will give them some support. Okay. Fourth framework, learning landscapes in higher education. We're now thinking a great deal about how do you design a a learning environment, a classroom, if you want to encourage collaboration between academics and students. And you can find, if you go to the blog, the Learning Landscapes at Lincoln blog, you can find a lot of information on this involving students and academics on thinking about all of these things. I did some work with Caroline and others when I was at Warwick, and we designed a classroom. And we wanted to design a classroom that enshrined the principles of critical pedagogy. You know, how would you design a classroom that enshrined the principles of critical pedagogy? So what we did was we stripped out all the furniture, we heated and rubberized the floor, the technology was ubiquitous but not apparent, you couldn't see any machines in the room, there was no PowerPoint in the classroom, there was no PowerPoint in the classroom, there was no point in this room, I'm the PowerPoint. There was no PowerPoint, so when you walked into the room, students didn't know how to behave, and neither did teachers. Very soon, people would adopt habitual behaviors. You had to whip them out of the corners and where they were sitting. But people were genuinely uncertain and unsure, uncomfortable. And my colleagues, Kath Lambert, has written rather wonderfully about this in an article called Psycho Classrooms, which you can get online. Psycho Classrooms, Teaching as My Greatest, which uses a quote from Joseph Beuys, where he says, teaching is my greatest work of art. So to reinvent the classroom as a performance, but not just the performance of the teacher, the performance of the student. And you might know, when you go into an Ofsted inspected classroom now, the inspectors aren't looking at the teacher. They couldn't care less about the teacher performance, not directly. What they're looking at is, what are the students learning? And how do I know what the students are learning from watching them? You know, from sitting in this room, an inspector wouldn't have a clue. It's all about me. Am I funny? Am I on time? You know, am I talking any sense? Are the students, you know, getting it somehow? But how would you know? So these are our challenges. Fifthly, is digital education. We have a new strategy. Joss Wynn and Sue Watling and Julian Becton and others are developing all of this in a radically interesting way, with students producer at the heart of it, by which we mean not the technology, not the machinery. We don't begin from the machine, we begin from the pedagogy and the practice. And we're going to use this to further embed students producer. Joss Wynn talks about hacking the university. It's a great idea, hacking the university. And I put some articles up on my Twitter feed that you can look at. And you might know there is a movement in Lincoln. There's so much going on in Lincoln, which is called hacking. What's it called? Hacking? Hackspace. So there's a lot going on in Lincoln, and we're connecting. Okay, so that's the second level. Embedding structures, we're in strategies, we're doing real things, but it's got an intellectual project behind it. The final strand is the third strand, and I've got about 5 minutes left, maybe a bit more. And that's the university as a radical political project to reinvent and defend the university, the public university. That's the point. And how we're doing this is, I think we're teaching each other about the history of the radical university. We're teaching the university to ourselves. And we begin, you remember yesterday I left you all dangling with Robert Gross Test and his big balls. Kevin's looking at me, what was he talking about yesterday? Robert Gross Test dangling. Lincoln is crucially important in the development of research, modern what we call research or science, through the work of Robert Gross Test, who was the Bishop of Lincoln. He lived from 1170 to 1253. He was the Bishop of Lincoln. He was the first vice chancellor of the University of Oxford, we think. And medieval historians writing about him suggest that he invented research method using what we knew from the Arab world and Arab universities, ancient Greek philosophy, new practical methods of doing science. He invented research method, a method where we could test hypotheses. And this method was a critique of the European university, because the European university, medieval historians suggest, wasn't about the production of new knowledge. It was about the imposition of the book of Christendom, of what we already thought that we knew, of the dogmatic medieval university. So Gross Test is the beginning of how do we produce new knowledge, designing and developing a research method. And not only a research method, but linked to a generalized hypothesis, a conceptual understanding. So induction and deduction, a sort of Aristotelian. I'm quickly getting out of my comfort zone, so don't ask me too many questions about this. Aristotelian, but this is what I'm reading in the books. And I have written about this, the Aristotelian method, induction and deduction. And the conceptual awareness was that light is the substance of everything. Light is the substance of everything. And God is the substance of light. So God is the substance of light. So a manifestation of Gross Test's experimental method is Lincoln Cathedral. Lincoln Cathedral is an experiment in light. It's not just a great big concrete structure. You might have noticed it's full of wonderful glass windows. So if you start to think about it in this way, and medieval historians and architects have written about this, one of the professors at this university has written about the cathedral as a cosmological idea. It starts to get very interesting. But the main point of what I'm trying to say is that Robert Gross Test has discovered science as a subversive practice. He's not building work on the shoulders of great people. He's undermining what we know in order to build something else. So Robert Gross Test's research is subversive knowledge. In that sense, the university cannot contain itself. The university cannot contain itself. The university cannot contain itself. Whatever managerial system they put on us, the fact that research and the production of new knowledge is the essential principle of what a university is means they simply can't contain us. And we know that because when we have ideas which are grounded in academic substance, they become pretty powerless, actually, those managerial languages at least. Not the violence of the imposition, that's a bigger issue. So we go right back to Robert Gross Test, Robert Big Balls. Then we shoot up to the beginning, not of the medieval university, but the new European university, the new modern university, Humboldt University in 1811. This was designed, again, as a critique of the medieval university, with research and teaching at its core, reconnecting research and teaching. Not lectures, not giving students knowledge, but new knowledge. The university was about the production of knowledge at the level of society. A university is what we know about ourselves, the principle of the university, not the institutional form. That's what higher means. And universities are not about teaching. Schools are about teaching. Scholasticism is about teaching. Teaching is an activity that's wrapped up in research and the production of knowledge. That's the point. You have to have the two things together. The founders of Humboldt University argued, who were liberal philosophers, which was their strength and, of course, their weakness. 1968, fast forward to 1968. It's not about student engagement. You know, you talk about how can we get students interested in higher education. They just sit and looking at me in the classroom, academics complain. I didn't see too many of those academics in the streets of London in 2010, in November, where students were walking into kettles with police dressed up in militarized uniforms, defending higher education. And in 68, students were right in the heart of the matter. As historians of the period argue, students were revealers of the general crisis. Andy Haggard and I have written about this in an article, The Pedagogy of Excess, which again you can find the link online. And the extent to which our curricula now has been what is now our mainstream curricula was very much derived from what was seemed like radical ideas that came out of the student protest movement in 68, like the Independent Project and the Independent Degree at North East London Poly and Lancaster University. So if we can learn things from 68, what can we learn from Occupy? What can we as academics learn from students right at the heart of the process? As we know, students set up a university outside St. Paul's. Anyone can teach, everyone can learn. And Sarah Amsler and I wrote a paper, Occupy, a New Pedagogy of Time and Space, which is thinking about some of the ideas. Okay, so finally, where are we now? Well, we're at the point where we are evaluating the HEA project against its internal and external aims and objectives. And I had hoped at this conference to be able to run that evaluation past you, but we're not quite as advanced as we would like to have been. So the evaluation is due by the end of July, so that's when we're going to write it up and you can read it. But at this point, we feel we have achieved a great deal, but there is still much to do. Yeah, we've achieved a great deal, but there is still much to do. So I think I'll end it there. Thank you very much.